Anna DeVlantis joins us now, as she does every Wednesday, for This Week in Chicago History. Very appropriate, Anna, that we start with Prohibition, since this is Dry January, isn't it?
That's right. And 103 years ago, to this date, Bob, Chicagoans were waking up with a major hangover. It wasn't dry for them until this morning because Prohibition had begun. And, you know, the night before, I saw, looked up all these archive photos. The taverns were packed with people just trying to get in one last legal drink before Prohibition began. Of course, it's a national story, but it's very much Prohibition, a Chicago story. If you think about what a center for bootlegging activities Chicago was, and Prohibition being the major catalyst for the storied rise of mob power in the city, the Al Capone gangster wars and such. Mm-hmm. But Bob, I found another connection too to the genesis story of Prohibition. If you look back, okay, so the 18th Amendment went into effect midnight, January 17th, 1920. Guess where the first documented violation of the law happened? Right here in Chicago. And I looked it up. The police reports just show you that, you know, it just started right away. Mob activity, organized crime. They had six armed men break into these railway cars, steal $100,000 worth of whiskey. And, you know, it was the beginning of much organized crime, and the mob power that dominated the city for years to come also gave rise to a soon to be famous Fed, Elliot Ness, who was stationed in Chicago to bring down guys like Capone. And who can forget the classic scene in the movie The Untouchables, when Sean Connery, the grizzly veteran Chicago cop, explains to Kevin Costner, who's playing Elliot Ness, how if you want to take these guys down, you better adjust to the Chicago way.
What are you prepared to do?
Everything within the law.
And then what are you prepared to do? If you open the ball on these people, Mr. Ness, you must be prepared to go all the way. Because they won't give up the fight until one of you is dead.
I want to get Capone. I don't know how to get him.
You want to get Capone? Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way. And that's how you get Capone.
I like Kevin
Classic
Costner.
Classic movie line there.
Yeah, Robert Stack is my preferred Elliot Ness, though.
There are many iterations. That just classic scene, though, is just beautiful.
Oh yeah, I love
it's,
that.
You know, of course, it's so good. Al Capone, of course, picked up for tax evasion, though, Bob, and didn't ever get him on the bootlegging stuff. So there you go.
We've been talking a lot about place kickers this week, and there is a note in Chicago sports history about that, isn't there?
Oh, painful anniversary for a lot of Bears fans, Bob. Back in 2019, Cody Parkey during the NFC wildcard playoff game against the Eagles. This is the moment when the Bears could have won the game. 10 seconds left. All Parkey had to do was make a 42-yard field goal. And instead, it just led to so much pain for Bears fans because he not only missed it, he double-doinked. Here was the call.
And, oh, he hits the upright again! That's impossible! And the Eagles run out into the field, but there's still 5 seconds. So they've got to get back. He does it again.
It will be Philadelphia.
Did this hit the upright and the crossbar?
Bottom line, it doesn't go through upright. It looks like it bounced off the crossbar as well.
Oh, my goodness. The Bears' season's going to end on a double doink.
Chris Collinsworth there with Al Michaels. Yes, we remember it all too well, don't we?
Oh, my gosh. Well, he had hit the upright, Bob, if you recall, 5 times during the regular season and 4 times in one game. And so it just to end the season that way was just, miserable, miserable. Andy, I don't know if you remember the reaction in the stadium. I heard they were booing, but they were stunned.
It was more stunned silence. Yeah, I was actually at home watching it, and I had the bad feeling that he was going to miss the field goal just because of history. And then you remember he went on one of the morning shows and really angered a lot of the Bears management and a lot of the players too.
who can forget? Thank you for reminding us about
that. No problem.
That,
double doink.
Michael Jordan and more coming up on This Week in Chicago History next. It's This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis. Let's talk about something that started here in Chicago and has now been copied by other teams, baseball and other sports too, around the league. Anna?
Yeah, just about every sport. You see fan conventions in the off season now, Bob, and that was John McDonough of the Cubs and then Blackhawks. He was the visionary behind that whole thing. The very first sports convention of its kind was the Cubs convention. It was held here in the city, 1986, at the Hyatt Regency Chicago. It was such a big deal that most news outlets in town didn't even cover it. I mean, they didn't pay much attention to it. It wasn't that well attended the first year, but by the second year, you know, it had turned into something pretty memorable. I pulled the Trib story from back then, and the Tribune reported these events that day. Outfielder Gary Sarge Matthews pleaded with manager Dallas Green to sign my good friend Andre Dawson. Several players urged fans to write to President Ronald Reagan to get lights at Wrigley Field. Ryan Sandberg sported a new mustache, and announcer Harry Carey carted around a plaque with a photo of a fired ball girl that he didn't want to have fired, I guess. I don't know the full story in that one, but what I do know that the second year it started to take off, and John McDonough, it was the visionary who created that whole idea of engaging your fans in the offseason. He brought it to the Hawks when he moved over to the Blackhawks for their convention, and then it just became the blueprint for professional sports teams for years, the fan convention across, as you say, Bob, all sports, you know, a lot of different teams will do it. It's pretty a pretty cool thing and very successful for a lot of teams and fans alike.
Started in 1986, and who could ever forget the ball girl, Marla Collins. And Michael Jordan.
Do you remember why was he so upset about her being fired? Do you know that story, Bob?
Harry liked her. Let's just put it that way.
Okay. All right. That's what I said. I wasn't sure I wanted to know the story, so we'll just leave it there. Thank you, Bob.
We saw Michael Jordan on TV in a new way on this day in 1984. Tell us about this.
So his first celebrity endorsement was a TV commercial for Chevy. That was his first endorsement deal as a celebrity endorser. It was a $200,000 deal with Chevy, and he did a lot of ads with them over the years. Many years he was part of that. He was still an endorser for them, but he was often playing basketball or doing something basketball related. We pulled this classic one of Michael Jordan's early Chevy ads, where Chevy decided it'd be a good idea to feature Michael Jordan showing up at the Secretary of State's office getting a driver's license.
Say your name, please.
Michael Jordan. I've made shots at the buzzer. I've been in championship games. But I've never had butterflies like this.
Show me your horn. Turn
These
signals,
people are all business.
Okay.
Good thing I had my Chevy Blazer along. Sure came through in the clutch.
D-O-F-T-P-Z-L-C-D-O.
Have a seat over in the blue chairs and wait for them to call your name.
I not only renewed my license.
Smile, look at the camera.
I renewed my confidence as well.
He's earned a few bucks since then, hasn't he?
Yeah, he sure has. You know, it's interesting because if you saw The Last Dance, they go into his endorsements and, you know, they even talked about how he really, really wanted to go with Adidas initially and not Nike. And then Dolores, his mom, told him, you know, go in and listen to what Nike has to say. And that was, changed the world in terms of, for Michael Jordan, for all of us. Air Jordans went on to sell $125 million that very first year. They've earned $1.5 on that one contract alone, Bob, so far. And, still a popular shoe. $1 billion Michael Jordan in his career so far. That one Nike contract, the one deal he struck. And you think about how popular Air Jordans are to this day. It's just, it's amazing what was created way back then, in the mid-'80s.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is another one of those items that you bring up here from time to time and that I have not heard about, but apparently it was very big and started right here. Tell us about the Rock'em Sock'em robot game.
So this wasn't a toy you had either, Bob. I know you said you didn't know the Light Bright. That wasn't something. But Rock'em Sock'em robots, you didn't have those?
No, apparently my parents didn't give me any toys. I'm now realizing that.
You were so deprived. What did you play with? I mean, my God. But anyway, this is a Chicago invention, a Chicago toy company, and it was two plastic robots. People remember they're still punching each other in a boxing ring, and one person controlled one of them, the red one, and one controlled the blue one, and you'd keep going until one of their heads fell off. What's not to love about this game? Very popular, has survived the generations, and here's an old TV ad that ran shortly after the toy's release in the mid-1960s.
You're slugging it out in the middle of the ring! And you have a hard right to the jaw! And Blue Bomb is Block is knocked off!
Is Block knocked off?
Sure,
were. But you can press it right back on again. It's just part of the action with the world's only boxing robots, the Rock'em Sock'em Robots by Marks. Takes two managers to handle the fighters and lots of skill to win. With these control levers, you can keep your fighters in motion to duck punches. When you press this plunger, he throws a right uppercut. Press the other plunger and there's a left jab. Lots of exciting action and fun for everyone when the world's only boxing robots battle it out.
Boy, this is the greatest!
You bet! The world's only boxing robots. Get the Rock'em Sock'em Robots by Marks.
Now, that's another toy I wish I had, but my parents told me, just go outside, find a twig on the ground, and play with a stick. So, unfortunately, that was my childhood.
Yeah, they really were a simple toy, Bob. There was the space version, there was a Transformers version, and now, just last year, Vin Diesel said that he was teaming up with Universal Pictures to do a live-action film based on the Rock'em Sock'em robots. So, I don't know how that's going to go, but... That's in the works, Bob. Something to check out.
Until next Wednesday, when you remind me of other toys I was deprived of, that's it for This Week in Chicago History. Thank you, Anna Devlantis.